Welcome to the podcast. Today's guest is Dr. Kevin Zorn. Dr. Zorn is a benign prostatic hyperplasia specialist at Steinberg Urology, Montreal. He has been an associate professor of urology at the University of Montreal and the University of Chicago, subspecializing in robotic surgery and benign prostatic hyperplasia surgical care. Dr. Zorn is the senior author of the Male Lower Urinary Tract Symptoms Benign Prostatic Hyperplasia Guidelines for the 2018 and 2022 Canadian Urological Association and has been an invited reviewer of the American Urological Association Benign Prostatic Hyperplasia Guidelines. He has now authored 345 peer-reviewed publications and 12 book chapters on benign prostatic hyperplasia and minimally invasive surgical care. We welcome Dr. Zorn to the podcast.
Hello. Today, we are going to do an update in urology podcast series. We're going to look at three articles which have a broad range of interest to urologists around the world. We're going to look at a systematic review of cases of Signet ring cell adenocarcinoma of the bladder. We're going to also talk about bipolar transurethral resection in patients with previously inserted metallic prostate stapling devices. And then we're going to talk about the efficacy and safety of a conservative management approach to radiation-induced male urethral stricture disease with elderly patients with comorbidities. So it's a broad range of topics that I think will have a far-reaching interest to a number of urologists. So let's talk about the first paper, which came from Australia, looking at a systematic review of 77 cases of Signet ring cell adenocarcinoma of the bladder. This is a very rare disease in patients. It's a very uncommon type of malignancy. And obviously, urothelial carcinoma is the most common type of bladder cancer that's seen. But Signet ring cell adenocarcinoma, which is a non-urachal type of bladder cancer, is characterized by an abundancy of intracytoplasmic mucin cells, which are displaced at the cell periphery, giving it a Signet ring appearance. This is a very commonly associated with gastrointestinal malignancies, and its occurrence in the bladder is quite infrequent. The presentation of adenocarcinoma of the bladder, as we all know, requires extensive metastatic workup to rule out extravesical primaries. And knowledge about Signet ring cell adenocarcinoma of the bladder is rare due to the limited number of case reports and case series that exist. We do know that Signet ring cell carcinoma is aggressive, with most of the patients presenting with muscle invasive disease with a high propensity of early metastasis and a poor prognosis. The scarcity and the fragmented nature of the available evidence has limited our understanding in the management of this rare bladder cancer variant. And this paper was primarily to provide a systematic review and looking at a comprehensive understanding of Signet ring cell carcinoma of the bladder, aiding clinicians in early recognition, appropriate management, and counseling of patients. So what the authors did is they searched using PRISMA guidelines of a number of databases, PubMed, EMBASE, and Medline databases, and they use key terms such as bladder cancer and Signet ring cell carcinoma combined with an English language restriction at this. And what they found is they looked at original articles reporting on the diagnosis of bladder cancer, studies that provided information on outcome, case reports, case series, and observational series and clinical trials. These were all the eligibility criteria for the articles that were included. Excluded articles such as commentaries, letters to editors, editorials, expert opinions, these were not included. So when we look at the databases, approximately 328 articles were initially identified, and after looking at the articles and collating them and using searches for these criteria, 38 articles emerged as articles to be studied and to glean information from. We know that the diagnosis of bladder cancer is based on histopathological examination of bladder tissue samples. We know that immunohistochemistry is performed to confirm the diagnosis. And we know that signet ring cell carcinoma is commonly mixed with other histological types of bladder cancer in upwards of 19% of cases. The typical immunohistochemical stains that are used are PAS. We also use CEA and EMA, you know, epithelial membrane antigen, carcinoembryonic antigen, and periodic acid shift to try to identify these patients. Imaging techniques used to identify bladder masses and assess metastatic disease are relatively standard with CT scans and MRIs and bone scans. And the data of the 51 patients that were identified in the study were examined, and we had data in about 62% of patients. The prognosis was similar across the board, and then we know that the 77 patients that were included in the study were worked up for gastrointestinal malignancy. We do know that of the 77 patients that were studied that we had patient demographics and characteristics of, the mean age was 64. Presenting symptoms were hematuria in about 64% of patients, lower urinary tract symptoms in about 46% of patients, and then abdominal pain and dysuria. And looking at the management of these patients, 50% of these patients underwent cystectomy, 24% of patients underwent radiotherapy as a primary modality, and 16% of patients underwent chemotherapy. And when you look at the mortality was 62% across the board, and the survival time was approximately 12 months in individuals. So if we take a deeper dive, looking at 41 patients in this series, or 50% of the patients that underwent cystectomy, 19 patients, or 24% of patients, received radiotherapy, and approximately 13 patients, or 16%, received chemotherapy. And the median survival of those patients that underwent cystectomy at 13 months was 37%. At 1 year was 14%, and then at 5 years, 9.4%. Nine patients had local recurrence or distant metastasis, and the time to recurrence was approximately 16 months. Non-metastatic patients with radical cystectomy initially done had a median survival of approximately 11.5 months, with 1, 3, and 5 year survival rates of 41%. 22%, and 16%. Chemotherapeutic regimens were heterogeneous in this population. Platinum-based chemotherapy was the most commonly used agent in these patients. And the median survival time for patients undergoing chemotherapy was approximately 12 months, with the most common recurrences and metastases occurring in the spine, liver, and the bowel. So the authors went on to provide a comprehensive review and trying to understand the clinical characteristics, the diagnostic procedures, and treatment strategies and outcomes in these patients with signet ring cell carcinoma of the bladder. The experience is largely based on our management of patients with high-grade transitional cell carcinoma. And the evidence that we use is relatively low, being limited to primarily case reports and case series. We do know that signet ring cell carcinoma predominantly affects males, aligning with what we see with patients that have bladder cancer. Clearly, hematuria is the most presenting symptom to patients, and this emphasizes the importance to think of not only, you know, bladder cancer, traditional transitional cell carcinoma, but also signet renal cell carcinoma in a differential diagnosis of patients that appear with blood in their urine. Diagnostic procedures involve, you know, histopathological examination using a variety of immunohistochemical markers like PAS, CAE, EMA, and cytokeratin. We do know that it's important with signet ring cell carcinoma to have radiographic exclusion of an extravesical primary. And it's important that these patients, you know, have their gastrointestinal tract examined to make sure that there's not a primary there associated with it. And then the therapeutic strategies for this type of cancer vary with multimodality therapy, including radical surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. The management guidelines are derived really from EUA and AUA protocols, and this stratifies patients based on disease stage. There's no question that immediate cystectomy may be necessary in advanced stages due to the aggressive nature of signet ring cell carcinoma. Survival rates are low, with 1 year, 3 year, and 5 year survival rates being 44%, 13%, and approximately 8.6% respectively. And clearly, radical cystectomy or radical surgery appears to confer the highest survival benefit in patients. Now, in this paper, the authors do suggest that the evidence is low based on case reports and case series. There's no prospective data looking at this because it's such a rare type of carcinoma. There is significant heterogeneity in the patient characteristics, treatment protocol, and outcome measures. And again, this study excluded non-English studies, which may have a language bias. So in conclusion, the author suggests that signet ring cell carcinoma is a rare and aggressive disease that has similar mortality rates across TNM stages. The clinical presentation, the diagnostic procedures, and the treatment strategies have all been highlighted with what I've discussed earlier. Gastrointestinal and gynecological primaries should always be excluded in these patients. An early radical cystectomy should be considered in patients with non-metastatic disease due to the aggressive nature of signet ring cell histology. That's our first paper. Our second paper is going to discuss the fact that patients that have previously inserted metallic prostate implant stapling devices, we should always be aware on how we treat these patients. Actually, let's start over again. Our second paper is entitled Beware of Bipolar Transurethral Resection of the Prostate in Patients with Previously Inserted Metallic Prostate Stapling Devices. And this is a paper that comes out of Australia. And as we all know, BPH is a common cause of lower urinary tract symptoms, and transurethral resection is probably the most common surgical procedure used to treat BPH. It is moderately invasive, and it does have side effects associated with it. Some of these side effects include retrograde ejaculation in men, and they require most commonly at least one night overnight stay in the hospital. And this has led to an interest in the development of minimally invasive treatment options, including using a prosthetic stapling device such as the UroLift, and also resume treatments. But clearly, implants in the UroLift system are made up of three components: a nitinol capsular tab, which is first deployed deep within the prostate tissue, a stainless steel urethral end piece, and then a polyester monofilament that holds the two pieces together. So this is what the UroLift device is. Many of you, I'm sure, have used this device in treating patients. In carefully selected patients, there's no question that the UroLift device can improve lower urinary tract symptoms and improve the quality of life while preserving sexual function. But when you look at the data, up to 13% of patients need surgical retreatment for their LUTS within 5 years of having a UroLift procedure. Up to 2% of the implants develop incrustation, especially if the urethral end piece is deployed near the bladder neck. Caution is also needed when performing a holmium laser enucleation of the prostate in these patients due to the metallic component of the implant. This group in Australia has used bipolar TURP with saline irrigation and a plasma system, one that's produced by the Olympus Corporation in Tokyo, Japan, and they've experienced 5 independent cases in which the metallic implant short-circuited and broke the bipolar loop on contact. So in 4 of these 5 cases, there was a clinically significant stimulation of the obturator nerve, which resulted in a potential kick that could potentially endanger the patient. The stimulation of the obturator nerve causes adduction, which causes this kick to develop. However, the good news is these authors report no severe significant adverse events associated with this. The broken loop was recognized, and the TURP procedure was continued using monopolar device with glycine irrigation. So when the authors went back and looked at the devices, the monofilament was easily cut through by the bipolar loop. Even if you were careful to go behind the staple with a buffer of tissue, you weren't always successful in averting damage to the loop. And in one case in their series, the metallic part of the stapling device became embedded in the bipolar loop itself. And this was only recognized after these 5 events occurred with different surgeons over a 4-month period. So the authors recommend that one consider using monotherapy when you have a UroLift procedure that you're going to resect the tissue, because bipolar energy uses electric current between 2 electrodes, and the stainless steel head from the implant has a higher conductivity, which causes direct coupling and leads to overheating and stimulating of the obturator nerve. There is no return electrode on these patients with bipolar technology, and thus prevents the least resistance pathway for the current to pass. We can also see this when patients undergo robotic prostatectomy and one has metallic clips, you can cause fibrosis and thermal damage. So one needs to be careful, not only in BPH type patients, but also patients that have undergone radical robotic prostatectomy. The green light therapy can be used, and often safety stoppages occur when you see a reflection of the laser off the staple. And documentation is really important to prevent this type of thing occurring in the future. So there's no consensus on whether previous stapling devices should be removed and if you should remove a number of staples. So I think the takeaway message from this paper is that patients that undergo UroLift procedures, that if they need to have a resection, you should use monopolar currents to resect it, as you don't get this short circuiting that takes place with bipolar energy, which can result in stimulation of the obturator nerve and lead to a kicking or an adduction in patients that have stimulation of that nerve. Our third paper is an interesting paper looking at the efficacy of conservative management for radiation-induced male urethral stricture disease in elderly patients with comorbidities. And this is an interesting paper coming from the Lahey Clinic and the University of California at San Diego. We do know that radiotherapy is a common modality to treat pelvic malignancies, especially prostate cancer and rectal cancers. And this is a large retrospective analysis that was generated from data from 2004 to 2013 that shows that at least 38% of patients with localized prostate cancer chose radiation therapy as their initial modality for treatment. So despite advances in technology, we do know that ionizing radiation can cause ischemia and fibrosis, which can lead to radiation-induced stricture disease. And this is a subset of urinary stricture disease. The reported incidence ranges from 1.7 to about 31% of patients in the United States. And the recurrence rate after urethroplasty ranged from essentially 10% to 27% in multiple series with a mean short follow-up in patients. We do know that urinary incontinence in these patients ranges from 7 to 50% in these patients, despite recurrent rates in the range of 40 to 60%, many elderly patients have multiple comorbidities that make them poor surgical candidates. And really, the goal of this study was a multi-institutional study to look at the outcomes of conservative management with radiation-induced urethral stricture disease for patients who were really not optimal surgical candidates, or they were unwilling to accept the risks associated with stricture recurrence in these patients. So what the authors did is they retrospectively analyzed the data from three fellowship-trained urologists. Decisions were made on patient-centered decision-making model, including counseling patients with the risks and benefits. And conservative management was defined as either urethral balloon dilatation, direct visual internal urethrotomy, or clean intermittent catheterization. So a number of patients were excluded if they had obliterative strictures, if they had a stricture in the pendulous urethra or the fossa navicularis, if they had bladder neck contractures, or they had a poor history of a urethral reconstruction or urinary diversion, or less than 3 months of follow-up. The demographics were analyzed, the pelvic radiation details were analyzed, and the stricture-related urinary symptoms were evaluated. The characteristics were assessed using retrograde urethrograms, voiding cystourethrograms, and cystourethroscopy were done. Treatment details were recorded, including the number of dilatations patients underwent, the number of direct visual internal urethrotomies, and the clean intermittent catheterization regimen that these patients were placed on. The primary outcome was to look at culture-proven urinary tract infections and the number of acute urinary retention episodes. And objective data was captured measuring serum creatinine levels, uroflow rates, and post-void residuals. And conservative management failure was defined as progression to reconstructive surgery or the placement of a permanent indwelling Foley catheter. Now, these authors examined data from 91 patients who had a median follow-up of 15 months. The average age was 75, the BMI was 26.5 kilograms, and the Charleston comorbidity index was 6. The indication for pelvic radiation was prostate cancer in 97% of patients and anal rectal cancer in approximately 3% of patients. And the radiation types included external beam radiation, brachytherapy, a combination of external beam and brachytherapy, and proton beam therapy. So all of these were analyzed. 81% of patients received primary radiation therapy for their prostate cancer, 19% of the prostate cancer patients received adjuvant or salvage radiation. And the most common urinary symptoms that were seen were slow flow rates, urgency, frequency, and nocturia. Urinary incontinence was reported in upwards of 60% of patients, and 90% of patients underwent urethral balloon dilatation, while 44% of patients underwent direct visual internal urethrotomy. Clean intermittent catheterization was used in approximately 40% of patients. So the main treatment outcomes were looking at serum creatinine, flow rates, and post-void residuals. And across the board, these all remained stable. 15% of patients had an acute urinary retention episode that required urgent treatment. 34% of patients developed a urinary tract infection, which required antibiotic therapy, and 2 patients developed urosepsis that required hospitalization. No patient developed severe end-stage chronic renal disease. Urinary tract infections remained stable across the board. The median number of pads and diapers per day remained stable. and four patients underwent a urinary sphincter placement without postoperative complications. If we look at the failures of the urinary tract infections, 20% of them failed conservative management strategies. 17% of these patients pursued urethral reconstruction, and 6 patients opted for ileoconduit diversion. And definitive indwelling catheterization or suprapubic tube placement was pursued in 22% of patients and 55% of patients, respectively. Failure rates were stratified by radiation type, external beam, brachytherapy, combination, and proton beam therapy. And in 91%, with at least 1 year follow-up, the failure of these patients was approximately 22%. These patients had a higher urinary tract infection episode, and success in the failure group, success and failure groups were comparable in conservative intervention and follow-up. So in this series, if we look at the treatment failures, we had 91 patients, 80% of patients avoided reconstructive surgery, 73 out of the 91 represents 80% that were avoided reconstructive surgery, and 18 out of the 91 or 20% failed conservative management. 56% of these, or 10 out of the 18 that failed conservative management, had a suprapubic tube. 4 out of the 18, or 22%, had a urethral catheter. 3 out of the 18, or 17%, had urethral reconstruction. And 1 out of the 18, or 6%, ended up having an ileoconduit diversion. So this is the largest multi-institutional conservative management outcome study on patients with radiation-induced urinary stricture disease. The majority of patients, or 80% of them, were able to avoid invasive surgery or permanent indwelling catheterization. Urinary incontinence rates were not affected by conservative strategies, leading to many patients opting for conservative therapy. And fewer serious stricture-related complications, including hospitalization for urosepsis and the development of severe end-stage chronic disease, occurred very, very infrequently. The high incidence of urinary tract infections in the failure group indicates the need for careful monitoring in these patients. The majority of the patients in this study underwent radiotherapy for prostate cancer. The mean stricture length was 2 centimeters, indicating the need for urethroplasty for bulbar urethral strictures greater than 2 centimeters. The majority of patients already presented with urinary incontinence before their management was commenced, posing a challenge in deciding whether to proceed with urethroplasty with the potential need for the subsequent placement of an artificial urinary sphincter. There's no question this study shows similar results with respect to the need for repeat intervention, suggesting similar progression and outcomes once the stricture is developed. The study was patient-driven, aiming to evaluate conservative strategies for patients with radiation-induced stricture disease. And this disease process is challenging to manage surgically. The risk of recurrent strictures and postoperative urinary tract infections can be significant. Patients undergoing urethroplasty complicated by urinary incontinence need to wait an additional 6 months before pursuing an artificial urinary sphincter. We do know that radiation-induced urinary stricture disease is common in elderly patients that have multiple comorbidities at baseline. This study, as the authors have suggested, did have some limitations. It was retrospective in nature, and there was a selection bias that existed. Further analysis of this population over longer follow-up really is recommended and hopes to be studied in the future. This study, though, does not advocate for conservative management over surgical reconstruction for all patients with radiation-induced urinary stricture disease. It just provides important data for urologists to understand in patient counseling, clinical decision-making, and assessment that these patients need to be followed very, very closely. So in conclusion, the author suggests that short-term follow-up, conservative management for strategies with patients with radiation-induced urethral stricture disease, such as endoscopic techniques and clean intermittent catheterization, appear to be effective for a majority, at least 80%, of elderly patients with comorbidities. This is important to consider with these patients that are not optimal surgical candidates, that patients that wish to avoid invasive surgery, patients wish to avoid the risk of worsening urinary incontinence or permanent indwelling catheterization. And again, close observation of these patients is warranted because of the risk of urinary tract infections and the development of acute urinary retention. Thank you. Hello?
Yes, sir. It's done?
Yeah, we're done.
Okay.
Is there anything you want to record, re-record?
Sultan?
Excuse me?
Sir, I'm asking my colleague.
Yeah, okay, Rohit.
Okay, yes, sir. Okay. I think everything was good, sir. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.